Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church, Episode 76, Caesar Baptized. Last episode, we left off with the death of Arius in Constantinople, just before the completion of the Emperor Constantine's tricennial anniversary. In this episode, we're going to shift our focus onto the first Christian emperor, as we conclude our coverage of his reign. For the past few episodes, Constantine has been somewhat sidelined in our narrative, as our focus has been on the complicated ecclesiastical politics of the Arian controversy. Despite the unpleasantness of the death of Arius and ongoing strife within the church, the tricennial celebrations were a sight to behold in Constantinople. July 25th, 336, marked the 30th anniversary of Constantine's accession. He was the longest reigning emperor since Augustus. It had been a world-changing 3 decades. When the emperor first came to power, the empire was ruled by the pagan Tetrarchy, and Christians were being viciously persecuted. Now Christianity was being promoted as the religion of the empire, under Constantine as sole ruler. In honor of the imperial anniversary, ambassadors from all over the world were present in New Rome. From Germania, to Ethiopia, to Nubia, and even as far afield as India, numerous nations and peoples were represented in the city, offering gifts and paying homage to the Roman emperor. Among those invited to deliver panegyrics to the Augustus was our church historian Eusebius of Caesarea. In the previous year, after the exile of Athanasius, Eusebius had delivered before the emperor an oration on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now he delivered an oration directly on the emperor himself. Eusebius's oration of praise to Constantine is one of the most famous Christian theopolitical texts from antiquity. The Palestinian eschews more overt Christian language and instead utilizes classical terminology to promote Christianity, probably with the pagan members of the court in mind. The emperor is compared to both God the Father and Christ. Just as one God reigns above, so too does one emperor reign below on earth. The empire and its ruler are earthly icons modeled after the kingdom of heaven. Constantine is presented as God's vice-regent on earth. Though building on earlier Greco-Roman concepts, Eusebius gives them an explicitly Christian interpretation. The Christian ideal of rulership laid out by Eusebius would remain central to the imperial office for the rest of the empire's history, an ideal which the Bishop of Caesarea delivered against the backdrop of the new Christian capital. So far, we've briefly covered Constantinople's founding and dedication, and the city has already become a regular location in our narrative. Today, though, we're going to take a more substantive look at New Rome. The founding and early history of Constantinople is replete with many myths and legends. In addition, like all cities, Constantinople did not remain unchanged from the time of its founding. New buildings, customs, and ceremonies were added and modified throughout the succeeding centuries. This all makes separating fact from both fiction and anachronism highly difficult. Now, for our story, a thorough review of the city is not really necessary. If you want to dive deeper into the history of Constantinople, then I would recommend Robin Pearson's podcast, The History of Byzantium. For our purposes, we'll focus on those aspects which relate most directly to the story of the early church. I've posted maps of Constantinople on the blog site so you can see its general layout. The city was surrounded on 3 sides by water, and therefore Constantine only had to build land walls on the western side. At the easternmost end of the city was the sprawling Great Palace complex. Just as the Circus Maximus lay next to the Palatine Palace in Rome, The Hippodrome of Constantinople was also adjacent to the palace, with the imperial box, the kathisma, connected to it. Here the emperor would appear to greet the crowds and preside over the games. Adjacent to the northeast of the palace and hippodrome were the huge public baths of Zeuxippus, which contained many works of art taken from across the empire. Next to the baths was the Augustaeion, the large ceremonial public square, which functioned much like the Forum in Rome. Running westward from the heart of the city was the Messe, the long, great colonnaded street. Along the Messe was an open circular space, the Forum of Constantine. On the north side of the Forum was the Senate House, while in the center stood the Column of Constantine, a massive porphyry structure which still exists in Istanbul today. Atop the column was naturally a statue of the emperor himself, holding a scepter, spear, and an orb. The statue faced east and seems to have depicted the emperor with a radiant crown of sunlight on his head. The statue may have originally depicted the sun god Helios and was hastily remodeled to resemble the emperor. I should note, though, that some scholars argue these solar features were later additions, based on a medieval copy of a late 4th century map. The statue was damaged and repaired throughout Constantinople's long history due to earthquakes and other events, and no longer survives today. Trying to determine what it originally looked like is somewhat difficult. There is some debate on whether or not Constantinople originally included pagan temples. Some scholars, following Eusebius, posit that Constantine completely obliterated the old Byzantium instead of just refounding it. Thus, no remnants of the old cult sites remained, and pagan temples were only first built when Constantine's nephew Julian came to power. Most scholars, though, think that some pagan shrines were spared or rebuilt, yet marginalized. Animal blood sacrifice was not permitted, and thus pagans were forced to worship in a Christian manner. In addition, as we've mentioned before, imperial agents had toured the east, confiscating precious metal from the temples. Gold and silver not melted down for coinage was joined with all manner of other artistic works Constantine's agents had also seized from temples. In Constantinople, this pagan temple art was desacralized, reduced to being mere ornamentation to beautify the emperor's new Christian capital. Constantine naturally built grand churches in his new city. The main church near the imperial palace was the Church of Holy Peace, or Hagia Irene. The sanctuary was dedicated to the peace Constantine had achieved with his victory over Licinius. The other main church was located in the far northwest of the city, on Constantinople's fourth hill. This was the Church of the Holy Apostles. Not only was this the greatest of the city's Constantinian churches, it also had connected to it the imperial mausoleum, where Constantine and many of his successors would be interned. The mausoleum contained 12 cenotaphs, empty tombs, commemorating the apostles. The emperor may have already deposited the relics of Saints Andrew, Luke, and even Timothy in the holy apostles, though other historians argue this occurred during the reign of his son. The Church of the Holy Apostles sadly no longer exists today, as the building was demolished after the Ottomans took the city in 1453. The Fatih Mosque in modern-day Istanbul occupies the site where the church once stood. One other Constantinian-era church is worthy of note. This was the Church of St. Mochios, which lay in the western suburbs outside the city walls. Mochios was a presbyter from the Macedonian city of Amphipolis, and was martyred in Byzantium during the Great Persecution. His death had occurred on May 11th, and it was on his feast day that Constantine dedicated the city. Once again, we see how important the cult of the martyrs was to the emperor. Their shrines visibly reinforced Constantine's conviction that God punishes the persecutors of his people and lifts up those rulers who honor him and his church. All these new churches needed copies of the Holy Scriptures, of course. The emperor wrote to Eusebius of Caesarea, asking the church historian to produce 50 copies of the Bible. Eusebius was, of course, a natural choice for the job, being both a renowned biblical scholar and overseer of the school and library of Caesarea. The Palestinian duly complied with the imperial request, and 50 beautiful Bibles were prepared and sent to the emperor. Some scholars have speculated if Constantine's request inadvertently forced the issue of the biblical canon. That is, with the emperor asking for copies of the scriptures, it naturally required at least Eusebius and his scribes to decide what was and what wasn't going to be included in the codices they produced. But there's really no evidence for this. As you know, most of the church's canon had been in place since the late 2nd century, and we still see Christians producing slightly different canon lists in later decades. Constantinople wasn't the only location where the emperor built churches, of course. We've previously discussed the major constructions which occurred in cities like Rome and Jerusalem. Other cities also received imperially funded basilicas. Nicomedia, the old eastern capital where Diocletian began the Great Persecution by demolishing its large church, had a new Christian sanctuary raised up by the emperor. In Antioch, construction began on the Domus Aurea, or Golden House, a beautiful large octagonal-shaped building dedicated to Holy Concordia, or Harmony. In addition to church building, Constantine continued to promote Christianity through his legislation. Back in 320, he repealed the Augustan laws against celibacy and childlessness, something which benefited the Roman aristocracy, but also, of course, Christian ascetics. Although this is disputed, many scholars contend that the emperor attempted to curtail the gladiatorial games, especially offensive to Christians, by decreeing prisoners who were ordinarily condemned to die in the arena to instead be sent to the mines. In the long term, however, gladiatorial combats continued. Such public spectacles were too popular even for the emperor to suppress. Constantine also made innovations in Roman law concerning unilateral divorce. Restrictions were placed on what constituted grounds for divorce, and, for the first time ever, there was now a legal distinction between consensual and non-consensual divorce. Though Constantine's religious policies remained generally tolerant, he did take some actions against non-Catholic Christians. Whereas the emperor had attempted to bring recent heretics and schismatics, like the Donatists, Meletians, and Arians, back into the church, older sects were not afforded this. Constantine regarded heresy as a threat to the salvation of his subjects. He firmly believed no one who called themselves a Christian should be outside the Orthodox fold. Specifically, the emperor targeted the followers of the Gnostic Valentinus, Marcion, Montanus, Novatian, and Paul of Samosata, groups we have discussed numerous times before. The emperor issued an abusive letter addressed to the heretics themselves and ordered his provincial governors to confiscate their churches, ban their assemblies, and destroy their books. These measures were not rigorously enforced, and all these groups continued to exist for centuries afterwards. The Novatians, even, being schismatics but otherwise orthodox, were later given legal recognition by the emperor. Rather, it seems Constantine wanted to frighten the rank and file into leaving these groups and joining the church. Eusebius remarks, probably from his own experience, how many of these converts were insincere and their entrance into the church merely caused more headaches for the Catholic clergy. On the pagan front, certain shrines which were especially offensive to Christians were suppressed. We've already mentioned the Oak of Mamre in Palestine. Among the other pagan sites the emperor destroyed were two shrines to the goddess Aphrodite in Nextdoor, Phoenicia. One was located at Afaka in the mountains of Lebanon, and was infamous among Christians for the acts of homosexuality committed there. The other was located in the city of Heliopolis, where ritual prostitution was practiced. The emperor outlawed the practice and constructed the first church in this predominantly pagan city. Afterwards, Constantine distributed alms for the poor through the resident clergy, hoping Christian charity would win the locals over to the gospel. The emperor also suppressed a temple of Asclepius in Cilicia, a prominent healing cult center associated with the sage Apollonius of Tyana, who the persecuting magistrate, Socinus Hierocles, had once compared Jesus to unfavorably. In Egypt, Constantine proscribed the local eunuch priests from performing the customary rites to ensure the annual flooding of the Nile. He also had the Bishop of Alexandria confiscate the Nilometer, the sacred cubits used to measure the Nile, from the great temple of Serapis and rededicated to the Christian god instead. For many of Egypt's pagans, such acts would have spelt cosmic disaster and prevented the Nile from flooding. But of course, the Nile still continued to give its yearly gift to the land of Egypt, thus confirming the power of the Christian deity. No doubt a major boon in the conversion of many Egyptians to Christianity. While Constantine generally promoted a public sentiment of disdain for pagan worship, outright suppression was rare. The previously mentioned examples were targeted for specific reasons, and from later evidence, it seems Constantine's efforts weren't always so successful in the long run. As you'll remember from our coverage of the Council of Nicaea, Constantine had found it distasteful that Christians would calculate the date for the Paschal feast with the Jews. The emperor shared with many of his co-religionists an antagonism towards Jews and their religion. He was especially concerned that Jews not have any power over Christians. Under Constantine, new laws were issued by which Jews were forbidden to proselytize Christians, own Christian slaves, or circumcise their Gentile slaves. Conversely, Jews who persecuted Jewish converts to Christianity were to be punished with death by fire. A notable Jewish convert to Christianity in this period, who was persecuted by his kinsmen, was Joseph of Tiberias, a servant of the rabbinic patriarch in Galilee, who, after embracing Jesus as the Christ, was given the rank of count by the emperor and sent back to Galilee with imperial funds to build churches and evangelize. Aside from these laws and his harsh rhetoric, though, Constantine's actions with regards to the Jews were fairly minimal. More importantly for Jewish leaders, the emperor reaffirmed their curial exemptions, the same exemptions Christian clergy also possessed. You may have heard that Constantine reiterated and modified the Emperor Hadrian's old ban on Jews entering Jerusalem, supposedly now only allowing them to visit the city on the anniversary of the temple's destruction so they could mourn its loss. However, the evidence for this is fairly thin. A contemporary Christian pilgrim from Gaul visited the city in the 330s and does mention that Jews entered the city to mourn on the anniversary of the temple's loss. However, he makes no explicit reference to the emperor legislating any sort of ban. The earliest source for this claim comes from a 10th century Arabic history, written some 600 years after the time of Constantine. Based on contemporary writings by other 4th century Christians, it seems that Jews did continue to live in and around Jerusalem. If there really was a ban, it may have either been a local measure or not especially enforced. In addition to church building and Christianizing legislation, Constantine's religiosity manifested in other ways. His coinage continued to incorporate Christian symbolism. One of the new series of designs he minted in his later reign was the prayer pose. These coins depict the emperor's head tilted upwards to the heavens in prayer to the Most High. Other imperial images and statues depicted the emperor in prayer to God, standing with his arms extended and his gaze lifted up. The emperor set daily time aside for private prayer. He diligently studied the scriptures and led his household in collective prayer, while also exhorting his ministers to do likewise. Constantine also frequently preached sermons to his court and other notables, where he denounced idolatry and argued for the truth of Christianity over paganism. The emperor was both an apologist and evangelist. He also delivered sermons to fellow Christians and invited other preachers to do likewise. The emperor's own speeches were delivered in Latin, and court scribes rendered them into Greek. One of his sermons has actually been preserved by Eusebius. Known as the Oration to the Saints, it was delivered before an assembly of Christian clergy in Nicomedia during Holy Week, just before the Council of Nicaea. The emperor enthusiastically kept the Lenten fast, and made sure that candles burned all night in Constantinople during the Easter Vigil. Then, on the day itself, he doled out gifts and largesse to the people to celebrate Christ's victory over death. The emperor also became well known for his acts of charity, to the praise of many Christian authors. Philanthropy and charity had, of course, been part of Constantine's wider ecclesiastical policy, as we've discussed before. It was a dramatically new element to the imperial office. As historian Timothy Barnes notes, citing Evelyn Patlagian, one of the most striking differences between the mentality of the old pagan Roman Empire down to Diocletian and the mentality of the Roman and Byzantine empires under Christian rulers was the acknowledgement by the rich and powerful that they had a duty of Christian charity, an obligation to help the poor. Like Diocletian, though, Constantine recognized the Roman Empire could no longer be ruled by a single man. Whereas Diocletian's succession plans fell apart, Constantine hoped to prevent this by establishing a new tetrarchy, bound together by their shared membership of the Constantinian dynasty. For much of his reign, Constantine had mostly kept his half-brothers, Dalmatius and Julius Constantius, at arm's length from power. But in the 330s, things changed. You'll remember that Dalmatius and Julius Constantius were the sons of Constantine's father, Constantius Chlorus, by his second wife, Theodora. Constantine's decision to begin incorporating his brothers into his regime has been attributed to the death of his mother, Helena. It is suggested that Helena did not want the children and grandchildren of the other woman, Theodora, to share in imperial power. Whether this was the case or not, by the 330s, Constantine's brothers and their families were swiftly given high honors and power. Both of his brothers were each given an ordinary consulship, as well as new prestigious titles and offices. Dalmatius, as you'll remember, was made censor and given power over the East, while Julius Constantius was styled patrician. The culmination of this trend came with the final expansion of the Imperial College. In the last years of his reign, Constantine presided over an Imperial College consisting of himself as sole Augustus and four young Caesars. First, his eldest son, Constantine II, elevated in 317 and based in Trier, with authority over the provinces of Gaul, Spain, and Britain. Second, his middle son, Constantius II, elevated in 324 and based in Antioch, with authority over the provinces of the Near East. Third, his youngest boy, Constans, elevated on Christmas Day 333 and probably based in Milan, with authority over Italy and Pannonia. Finally, on September 19th, 335, Constantine elevated his nephew Dalmatius, the oldest son of Dalmatius the Censor, and established him in the Balkan city of Nisus, with authority over the dioceses of Moesia and Thrace. All four Caesars had their own capitals, courts, and praetorian prefects, hand-picked by the emperor. I've posted a map of these divisions on the blog site. Note, though, that the Diocese of Africa appears to have been temporarily organized under a separate praetorian prefecture at this time. Familial bonds were further strengthened by interdynastic marriages. The emperor's middle son, Constantius, was married to the daughter of his uncle, Julius Constantius, and the emperor's daughter, Constantina, was married to Dalmatius's younger son, Hannibalianus. Other dynastic marriage arrangements also took place, including the betrothal of Constans to the daughter of the praetorian prefect, Oblavius. Constantine thus established a new tetrarchy of emperors to succeed him, bound together by both blood and marriage. The younger Caesars would be assisted in their rule by the older generation. All that remained was for Constantine to, at some point, elevate his two oldest sons to the rank of Augustus. In the late 320s, the emperor had built numerous massive bridges and other offensive fortifications along the lower Danube. Throughout the 330s, Constantine won a series of major victories over the barbarians north of the river. In 332, he and his eldest son won a major victory over the Goths. The Goths then became client subjects of Rome, and the emperor's treaty with them not only opened the door up for trade, but also the spread of the Christian faith, something we'll discuss in more detail when we cover the Christianization of the Goths. In 334, Constantine settled Rome's Sarmatian allies south of the river. Finally, in 336, Constantine reconquered part of what had once been the old Roman province of Dacia on the far side of the Danube. This area had been first conquered by Trajan in the early 2nd century, but was abandoned during the crisis of the 3rd century. Not only was Constantine the first emperor since Augustus to reign 30 years, he now also shared the distinction of having the victory title Dacicus Maximus. Only Trajan had ever possessed the title Dacicus before. Augustus and Trajan were considered by the Romans of the 4th century to be the empire's greatest rulers, and Constantine had deliberately modeled aspects of his reign after them. Trajan, of course, was famous not just for his conquest of Dacia, but also his conquests in the east. The final years of Constantine's reign saw the beginning of a new war with the Sassanid Empire. Rome and Persia had not engaged in a major conflict since Galerius's crushing defeat of the Sassanids back in 298. That was all about to change. The origins of this Roman-Persian war have been controversial since the late 4th century. The war ultimately lasted for nearly 30 years and ended with a humiliating Roman defeat in 363, when Constantine's nephew, Julian the Apostate, the last pagan emperor, was killed in battle against the Persians. In the aftermath, pagan apologists quickly took to defending Julian by blaming Constantine for needlessly starting the war in the first place. In contrast, Christian apologists wrote to absolve Constantine and blame Julian. This debate has left an indelible mark on the ancient record, and thus, whether directly or indirectly, colors the views of modern retellings to this very day. I plan to discuss these events in much more detail in future episodes, when we cover the rise of Christianity in Armenia and catch up with the Church of the East. For now, I'll give a brief summary of the events which led to the war. When Constantine conquered the East in 324, he received an embassy from the Sassanids. Constantine responded by personally writing a letter in his own hand to the young Persian King of Kings, Shapur II. In the letter, Constantine waxes about his adoration of the Christian God, who exalts the rulers who protect his people and punishes those who persecute them. Constantine specifically discusses the humiliating fate of Valerian, the persecuting emperor who, as you'll remember, was captured alive by Shapur's great-grandfather and namesake way back in 260. Constantine concludes the letter by sharing his elation that Persia also includes many Christians. The emperor commends them to the care of the Sassanid king, telling Shapur to love his Christian subjects so that he too may receive God's blessings. Constantine's letter to Shapur has often been interpreted as a veiled threat where the emperor claimed patronage over the Sassanid king's Christian subjects, hinting that he would use their maltreatment as a pretext to invade Persia. According to this version, Shapur, goaded by Constantine's warmongering, eventually began making moves against Roman territory, before then persecuting his own Christian subjects, believing them to be a fifth column. This traditional interpretation has been severely challenged in recent years, however, something we will discuss in a future episode. Whatever the letter's impact, if any, on Roman-Persian relations, it was over a decade before war broke out between the two empires, and a few years after that before Shapur began taking measures against his Christian subjects. Whether or not he was suspicious of the loyalty of the Christians in his empire, Shapur was certainly concerned about the Christianization of other neighboring kingdoms. The king of Armenia had already converted to Christianity back in 314. In the 330s, another Roman client king in the Caucasus also converted, the ruler of Iberia, modern-day Georgia. Around the same time, the king of Aksum, modern-day Ethiopia, also embraced Christianity. We will discuss these royal conversions in more detail down the road, but for now, it seems the Persians began to fear the possibility of envelopment by a Roman-led alliance of Christian monarchs. Whether it was Constantine's supposed warmongering, or Shapur just wanted to restore Persian honor and recover what his grandfather had lost, the Sassanids began making moves around 335 or 336. Persian forces began raiding Roman Mesopotamia. Even more aggressively, the Sassanids invaded Armenia, deposed the Roman client king, and installed Shapur's brother on the throne. In response, Constantine bestowed on his nephew and son-in-law, Hannibalianus, the title of King of the Pontic Peoples, apparently with the intention of placing him on the Armenian throne once the Persians were driven out. The Romans succeeded in taking the country back, but restored the Armenian royal house instead. Constantine then changed Hannibalianus' title to Rex Regnum, King of Kings, in a direct challenge to Shapur. Preparations began in earnest for a massive invasion of the Sassanid Empire. Though the Persians sent embassies offering peace, Constantine rejected these overtures as insincere delay tactics. In the spring of 337, the emperor planned to join his son Constantius at Antioch, probably make him co-Augustus, and then father and son would conquer Persia together. Like Trajan before him, Constantine had first conquered Dacia and would now conquer Babylonia. Hannibalianus would then be installed in Ctesiphon as the new King of Kings. Upon his return from what would be his final and greatest campaign, the emperor would at last be baptized in the Jordan River, just as Christ had been by John the Baptist 300 years earlier. Constantine's Persian campaign was to have explicitly Christian overtones. Just as he had used a tabernacle in the war with Licinius, so too would the emperor have a mobile church constructed to accompany him on his last campaign. Bishops would travel alongside the legions, offering their prayers, and the conquest would open the door for the evangelization of Persia. Or so we're told. Again, we'll discuss the origins of the war in more detail down the road. For now, though, we'll simply note that a number of modern scholars think Constantine's planned Persian campaign was more an act of saber-rattling meant to cow the Sassanids. Despite how vigorous he had felt in the preceding months, age was about to finally catch up with the sextenarian emperor. Constantine attended the Easter Vigil in Constantinople on April 3rd, but soon began showing signs of illness. The emperor sought relief in the city's hot baths. After that, he began making his way to Syria. However, his health started to decline precipitously. After crossing the Sea of Marmara, he stopped in his mother's city of Helenopolis, where he made use of the nearby hot springs and prayed in the church dedicated to the martyr Lucian of Antioch. By May, though, the emperor knew his time was near. Constantine, therefore, at last became a catechumen, after making confession of his sins in the martyrium and receiving the imposition of hands. From there, he proceeded onward to an imperial villa at Ancyrona, a suburb of Nicomedia. There, the ailing Augustus expressed to the assembled bishops how he had desired to be baptized in the Jordan River, but believed his time was near, and God knows what is best for his mortal servants. Constantine had delayed his baptism until he was near death. Such a practice was not uncommon at the time, even if churchmen railed against it. Early Christians took very seriously the committing of sins after baptism. Once one had been born again of water and of the Holy Spirit, sin was supposed to cease. Constantine seems to have understood that being a good Christian stood in tension with being a good emperor. On May 19th, the baptismal ceremony took place. Constantine removed all his imperial regalia, and Eusebius of Nicomedia administered the holy rite. The emperor was anointed, and exorcism was performed. Then he was immersed in the waters three times under the Trinitarian formula. Finally, the laying on of hands was performed, and Constantine received the Holy Spirit. The emperor was then clothed in the white robes of a new Christian. Never again would he don the imperial purple. Reclining upon a couch, the emperor offered thanks to God. Farewells and last instructions were given to the leading officers of the state and the army. Finally, on the Feast of Pentecost, May 22nd, 337 AD, Constantine the Great died. He was 64 or 65 years old and had reigned for over 30 years. How does one even begin to sum up the life and legacy of Constantine the Great? Few individuals have managed to transform the world as much as he did. We began the century with the Great Persecution, and now we find ourselves in the new era of the Christian Roman Empire. I find myself unable to offer a pithy summation of the significance of the first Christian emperor. So next episode, we'll spend some time looking back and evaluating Constantine's reign and its impact on the early church. I also want to hear from you, dear listeners. What questions do you have about Constantine and the early church? Please let me know. You can send in your questions by emailing me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, as well as messaging and commenting on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and by commenting on the blog site, historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to reading your questions.